Having read that section of scripture, then we'll hand the evening over to Mr. Clive Snowman to speak to us on that subject. Atheism is dead.
Just make sure Matt gets safely down to a chair. Good evening, everyone. I must state at the outset of this presentation that I am certainly not a scientist. At best, probably a second-rate horticulturalist, and perhaps a reasonable Bible student. However, I'm not ashamed of that because, at the very least, it's provided me throughout my lifetime some ability to observe and draw conclusions. And I think that's a very important part of life, to be able to do that, to observe rationally and draw conclusions. Now, I know we all think our thoughts are rational, but I think mine are most of the time. But I'm going to begin tonight by giving you three word definitions. And I think these three word definitions are fundamental to our understanding of this subject. The first one you know well, it's in our title. The second and third may require some further thought. Then, God willing, we will continue with a number of observations that form my deep belief that there is a God who has created a fine-tuned earth and a fine-tuned universe. The earth and heavens, perhaps more to the point for us tonight, and mankind that inhabits this wonderful earth, God created all this for one single purpose, and that was to give him glory. So then we hope to conclude, well before 8 o'clock, with some personal thoughts, hopefully that will be the takeaway thoughts for our presentation tonight. So first of all, here are the root of the word meanings. The first one, of course, is atheism. Now, atheism we put up as a noun. It describes it's a person who disbelieves or lacks belief in the existence of God or gods, as he is a committed atheist. Now, I think that it mostly points to the disbelief in a particular God, which may well be the God that we worship and the God of the Bible. They're not particularly so committed to the worship of other gods, but we are targeted here in terms of their venom and their belief. So the first word is atheism. It means people who say there is no God. The second one is an adjective that we would use to describe someone who, in an argument, in a discussion, appeals to feelings or prejudices rather than intellect. It means ad hominem, which means to the person. So if you're debating something, it may be whether there is a God, whether atheism is dead, or whether atheism is alive. But when you're debating, very often people can't put their argument together to support their point of view. So what they do is they attack you as a person and undermine your character rather than answer and provide answers to contentions that are made. The third one is a word that I'm not sure I heard until about 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, gaslighting. The expression which derives from the title of a 1944 film, Gaslight. Now, I've been around since 1945, but I never actually heard of this film. But the term became popular about 10 or 15 years ago, probably because of the intense political debate that's been going on. But the term may also be used and is used to describe a person, a gaslighter, who presents a false narrative to another group or person. The gaslighter presents a false narrative to another group or persons, thereby leading them to doubt their perceptions and become misled, disoriented, or distressed. Now, this is because in the film, I think there was a a gentleman, I was going to say gentleman, but this guy who was gaslighting his wife by turning down the gas lamp, making her think that she was losing her eyesight and her mind, when in fact she actually wasn't. Leading them to doubt their perceptions, to become misled, disoriented, or distressed. Oftentimes, this is for the gaslighter's own benefit. Normally, this dynamic is possible only when the audience is vulnerable, such as in unequal power relationships, or fearful, or losses associated with challenging the false narrative. People don't take well to challenging the narrative, so what they do is they try and gaslight, in this term, people who don't see things their way. It's not necessarily with malicious intent, but in most cases, it seems to be. Now, these words were kind of brought into focus for me about 15 years ago when I had the privilege of attending a conference in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. And at the time, this was brought together by, I'm not quite sure who funded it or organized it, I think it was the Anglican Church of Nova Scotia. And there was a group of people who were brought together, mostly theologians, creationists. They were Christian people, to respond to the fashionable, irrational rantings of a group of folks known as the New Atheists. Now, this was a kind of a hip kind of bunch of professors from colleges, Britain mainly, who had decided that they were the cool new atheists and had all the answers in relation to atheism. And they had all these arguments, of course, to present. And it turned out fairly quickly that in a number of books that they had written, and I have a few of them, I don't suggest you buy them, it's old news now, but in these books and in their presentations and the media and so on, they were busy gaslighting people with a false narrative, and in that process intimidating people who believed in God, thinking, oh, well, I guess we are stupid because of all this amazing information that these people had. So you see how it goes. So they said that those of us who believed in God were foolish, stupid, uneducated, and they, of course, had all of the answers. So atheists making ad hominem attacks against Christians and people who believed in God, and when they didn't bend quickly, they just carried on with this gaslighting, repetitious, mean gaslighting. You don't read about them much anymore. You don't hear about them much anymore. And I'm not going to mention their names because it's not important. But at this particular conference, there was, I think, four speakers. One of them was a very elegant lady from England, who was the curator of the Bodleian Library in Oxford. And she spent just about an hour taking these people apart. It was quite fascinating. And after I got through listening to her, I thought, these guys are in big trouble. Big trouble. And they are, by the way, and I hope to kind of bring some thoughts to you this evening to support that notion. Now, some of you were here in 1966, not here, but living on Earth. I was, and this was the cover of the Time magazine that really stirred up some thoughts, this question that was presented. And it was presented, I think, in a manner that really implied that God was dead. And they give all kinds of reasons why now God was probably dying from society. And this is, 56 years ago. So our topic this evening is a bold play on this infamous Time magazine of April the 8th, 1966. And today we can confidently confirm that God is not dead, And the evidence that there is a creator God who has fine-tuned the world we live in has literally been exploding over the past 56 years. The evidence has been exploding to prove that there is a God who has fine-tuned the world we live in. So tonight we're sort of heralding the death of atheism, which is easy for us to do, but it still exists, of course. Atheists still exist. And unhappily, it is increasingly the popular worldview, certainly in the Western world in which we live. People worldwide who believe that there is no God, but the arguments that they use to support their fanatical religious beliefs are very much alive and something that we really need to understand as best we can. I did say fanatical religious beliefs, which is an interesting play here on positions and words, because that is exactly what they accuse us of, having fanatical religious beliefs and being completely unaware or unwilling to consider science, as they called it, because their position, of course, was built on science. But anyway, theists, if we come down to the actual argument, are clearly gaining the upper hand in this debate. And I think there's a reason why these new atheists have been rather quiet on the world scene for the past number of years. Now, I'm somewhat indebted to a book that I bought about 6 or 8 months ago by a Christian writer named Eric Metaxas, who poses this question, is atheism dead? He poses the question in a cheeky, sarcastic manner because he clearly believes that atheism is dead. Atheism no longer has any credence, has any platform to present their views. And from the front flap, this is a comment that's made about Metaxas in a voice that is by turns witty, muscular, and poetic. Metaxas intentionally echoes C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton in cheerfully and logically making his astonishing case. Along the way, presenting breathtaking and often withering new evidence and arguments against the idea of a creatorless universe. Interesting. Need to read that again. Making his astonishing case, along the way, presenting breathtaking and often withering new evidence and arguments against the idea of a creatorless universe. Taken altogether, he shows atheism not merely to be implausible and intellectually sloppy, but now demonstrably ridiculous. Finally, perhaps the only unanswered question on the subject is why we couldn't see this sooner and how embarrassed we should be about that fact that it's taken us so long to figure that out. So here's Metaxas in his own words. God, who made us in his image, has created all of creation to point us to himself in every conceivable way. God, who has made us in his image, as we read this evening, has created all of creation to point us to himself in every conceivable way. We are not incidental to what he has done. We are central to it. Where the ideas of evolution would put mankind as being incidental to the process. No. We are not incidental to what he has done. We are central to it, which makes us see that his love for us is so impossibly and unimaginably great that it really is infinitely too much for us to bear. So much evidence that proves the glory of God and the existence of God, that it's, well, mind-boggling. He didn't say that, but it's just too much for us to bear. If he did not shield us from it in some way, we would really and truly undo ourselves. It would destroy us. Now, I think we can see when we read the Bible that there is so much that is beyond our comprehension, even though we have far more knowledge today. Even a marginal horticulturalist like myself has so much information available that you can almost push yourself to the point of blowing your mind or going mad. Well, that's sort of what Job said to us in the Bible in Job chapter 42, verse 1 to 6. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear and I will speak, I will question you, and you make it known to me. I heard of you by the hearing of my ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. And I think this is, with all fairness, the point that Metaxas finds himself in as he considers this amazing argument. This is an excellent summation of his argument. The fine tuning, the detail of the universe, of our solar system, of our earth, is overwhelming. The minute details are so overwhelming that we can only prostrate ourselves on the ground as Job did, admitting our own limitations, and place all things in the hands of this great creator, the living God. And of course, that is precisely what the world doesn't want to do. That is precisely why the atheists want to argue this point, because they do not want to submit to the reality, to the obvious, to the overwhelming evidence that there is a God. In fact, the testimony of Job is clear evidence, but the more we understand about this fine-tuning creator, the more it brings us to our knees, despising ourselves as being nothing before him. And I suppose that's kind of the good thing, if we can say it that, about the atheist argument. They don't have to face these realities, these responsibilities. They can just carry on gaslighting and bullying and shouting and hollering and calling people out with their vain accusations to try and find some way to avoid facing the truth. Now, I have another book that I bought just recently, and if you'd like to borrow this from me, I'm happy to loan it to you. Originally, I had to buy it because our son Stephen's quoted in the book, so I had to spend the $90 to buy it. Or 75, but it's an amazing book. Stephen C. Meyer is a scientist who began as an atheist, and through his studies, learned about God. He wrote a book called, originally, which was a New York Times best-selling book, called Darwin's Doubt. So Darwin had a lot of doubts, and most of us are somewhat familiar with the theory of evolution, where, you know, biological structures seem to evolve, but we really don't know quite how it got from here to here. So you have these gaps, but eventually you think, well, we got there because we started here. So he could take trips, for example, to the South Seas and watch the finches as they rub their beaks against the rocks, and coming back a few years later, finding out that some finches had shorter beaks and some had longer, and that was partly because they rubbed their beaks, so he had to conclude, rub their beaks on the rock to make them sharper, so they could hunt better. But in any case, you end up with a situation where you have these gaps, and this James Tour, who writes a comment in Meyer's book, when you don't understand the details of living systems, as Darwin really didn't, with all due respects to Darwin, they didn't have microscopes and all the details we have today. So if you don't understand the details of living systems, ignorance permits discounting a creator. Well, you can say, well, there's no creator because I just think it was here and then it changed into that and it changed into that and so on. But here's the problem. When the details of science are thrust upon you, you're forced to ask, how on earth, literally, how on earth did it happen? How did that happen? Thus the God hypothesis returns. Now the scientists were writing about the return of the God hypothesis. Stephen Meyer convincingly drives the point home. How could it be this way? How could we be this way? How could the earth be this way? Only with God. So as we proceed tonight, I have a few observations that I would like to present to you in three different elementary areas of knowledge and discovery. First of all, a few thoughts about our solar system. Secondly, some thoughts about the human cell. And these are internet thoughts, because I'm not a cellular biologist or a molecular biologist, but these are things and bits of information that we can all have freely from available sources. So first of all, some observations about our solar system. Secondly, some observations about the human cell. And thirdly, some observations from archaeology. Apart from discussing all of the issues of the solar system and the human cell and biology and so on, and how we got here, there's one important thing that must be understood. And that is that these domains that we're going to talk about all unequivocally point to a creator God, a fine-tuning creator God. And thirdly, when we get into archaeology, point to his living word, which is in the Bible. And we'll see how the Bible actually becomes a very reliable book of history. So first of all, some observations from our solar system, the human cell, getting ahead of myself here, and number three, archaeology. So Metaxas goes on to explain what is known as this fine-tuned argument. This, he says, and others say, is a problem that the atheists just go quiet about. This is a problem that the atheists just go quiet about. It turns out that the more science looks at all these bits and pieces of the universe, and there is more and more evidence about design every day, because there are just too many parts, and that are and have to be just right before things work. They actually call this the Goldilocks principle. You all know about Goldilocks. As with her story, her and the three bears, the table and the chair and the bed had to be just right. If it was too big, it was too big. It could be too small. It could be in the middle. But it had to be, for Goldilocks, just right. So that's what they call this, the Goldilocks argument. That is why things are in the solar system and the universe, because everything is just right. And there are innumerable examples of these sorts of issues. So many beyond comprehension that we can't just say it was kind of, well, good luck or coincidence. So they have always accused us, people who believe in God, who have faith, of clinging to our faith against the evidence of science. Well, science, of course, they think is the authority, and they have science, and so therefore all we do, people of faith, is just cling to our feelings and our faith and our scriptures. The problem now is, of course, that it's them that are clinging to their false faith of science in the face of overwhelming evidence that they got it wrong. They got it all wrong. But that is now their faith that they're doubling down on. So here's our solar system, and we're all familiar with this, and we're not really quite sure about some of the bits and pieces of it. there's some planets, and there's some real small planets way out there. They are in perfectly fine-tuned balance. And I don't know much about Jupiter and Saturn and all of these planets, but I think I know a little more about the moon. So we're going to have a little look at the moon. But before we do, this is Metaxas again on page 38. The idea that people of faith cling to God to avoid science has been replaced with the idea that atheists cling to their science to avoid the real God who created the universe that science is now discovering, and whose existence is increasingly undeniable because of these very discoveries. That deserves a second thought. The idea that people of faith cling to God to avoid science has been replaced with the idea that atheists cling to their science to avoid the real God who has created the universe that science is now discovering and whose existence is increasingly undeniable because of these very discoveries. So let's talk about the moon for a few moments. The moon is extremely large in relation to other moons in our solar system, about 27% of the size of the Earth. This means it has a steadying influence on our planet, making it wobble a little bit less on our axis, providing virtual stability to our climates. If the moon wasn't doing that, we just wouldn't have stability with our climates and with our weather. However, it is also large enough that it has enough gravity to cause our ocean tides, crucial to our ecosystems, to rise and fall, which is vital to the rest of life on the planet. The details of the moon are absolutely crucial to life on Earth. Now, in my searching of the internet, I read books too. I don't just look on the internet, but I read books too. Some joker said that the moon is absolutely useless to the Earth. It has absolutely no relation to the Earth at all. We could just get rid of the moon and we'd just be just as fine. We just wouldn't be able to write songs about the moon. You read that on the internet too, so you have to be discerning and say, just a minute, that's nuts. The Earth can't survive without the moon. There are no other moons in our solar system that come close to matching the unique values of our moon. So at some time in the past, and we're not into dating any of these things, there was a perfect collision between two planet-sized spheres forming Earth as we know it and a perfectly sized moon. This was a miracle as the results for the habitable Earth's atmosphere and the amazing perfectly sized in place moon being about 27% the size of the Earth orbiting around it. Now, Mercury and Venus have no moons. Mars has two. Both are so small on Mars that they are hardly worth being called moons. Jupiter has an expanding number of moons. I think 53 plus, and check if I'm wrong. It's okay. Earth has one moon. And I think, again, there are more than 200 moons in the whole solar system, large and small. Most of the major planets, all except Mercury and Venus, have moons. Pluto and some other dwarf planets as well have, and some asteroids also have small moons. However, none are believed essential to the atmosphere of the planet or the asteroid. Our moon is just right, a finely tuned, purpose-built element and event in the solar system. That if things had not been fine-tuned, if things had been slightly different, well, we simply wouldn't be here. Now, a couple of comments about eclipses, which are amazing, I think. We all know about them. Some of us have seen them, I guess. Distance of the distance between the Earth and the Sun is about 93 million miles. The distance from Earth to the Moon is about 240,000 miles. Distance from the Earth to the Sun is almost exactly 400 times the distance from Earth to the Moon. The diameter of the Sun is 865,370 miles. The diameter of the Moon is 2,159 miles. The diameter of the Sun is almost 40 times the diameter of the Moon. These two heavenly bodies look exactly the same size from the vantage point that we have on Earth. Because of this, we have total eclipses on Earth, in which one disk completely covers the other, as we know. Nothing close to this happens on any other planet, only on Earth. A rational mind might suspect that this is perhaps no coincidence. But in fact, oddly, it actually was intended for us. This phenomena of the moon intended for us. Well, we have to move on. We read this evening my answer to this, and I think probably many of yours as well. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day and the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light to the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. And, by the way, the stars also. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on earth, to rule over the day, to rule over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. Just right, finely tuned. Here is what I place my faith in. God said, God set. Takes us to our second category. You better make this a lot quicker. A testimony of biology. No, I'm not a biologist, but I'm a half-baked horticulturalist, and what I do know is that biological structures and systems cannot exist without all the pieces being together and working at the same time. Now you can take your eyeball, and if you don't have a retina, it doesn't work. In all the pieces of your eye, your ear, and so on. Biological structures and systems cannot exist without all the pieces being together and working at the same time. I think that's a reasonable statement. Now the cell, of course, is very small. We'll give you some numbers on that in a few moments. It's made up of many, many, many different parts. It's complex. It's a fundamental unit of the human body. The question always is, could this evolve? Well, as I said, these things take time. But even still, could it possibly evolve? Because we understand that this cell, if it's missing a couple of these hundreds of parts, wouldn't function at all. And of course, cells join together and create larger biological structures and human bodies and so on. Could this evolve? And I think the answer to that is no, it didn't, and it can't. The human cell will not exist or function unless all the parts are there functioning. And we can go on to talk about the cell, and there's lots of information on the internet again, and I just popped this up from the National Cancer Institute from one of their training modules, and you can read all kinds of amazing things about the cell. And I'm often left wondering, that if these people are saying these things and studying these things and writing these things, how can they possibly say that it just evolved or it happened? How can people who actually understand these things and study them come up with such simplistic solutions? Of course, the human cell has all kinds of different cells. Human body, and these are some cell types. Stem cells, bone cells, blood cells, muscle cells, sperm cells, which are unusual because they're what they call diploid cells. Is that right? They can't divide. There's only one chromosome. Majority of cells carry two chromosomes called diploid. Female egg cells, fat cells, nerve cells. How many cells are in the human body? Well, I haven't counted them, and I'm sure you haven't, and many people have tried to do this mathematically to come up with some kind of an idea, and there's probably at least 30 trillion cells excuse me, in the human body. But that's not all, because we also have bacterial cells, which outnumber the other cells in the human body. And doing a little bit of current biological reckoning, we have 900,000 species of insects. We have 400,000 species of plants. We have 1,700,000 species of animals. We have 8 billion humans on Earth by the end of 2022. I think that's what they're telling us. And here's a comment from Metaxas. Some people believe God created all life forms and was involved in how all life forms came into being. That he intended to create all life, including humans, and he did. Others believe that there is no God, so everything happened by accident, randomly evolving from a single cell all the way up to the life that now exists. You don't like, this is good water, is it? Some people believe God created all life forms and was involved in how all life forms came into being, that he intended to create all life, including humans, and he did. Others believe there is no God, so everything happened by accident, randomly evolving from single cell all the way up to the life that now exists. I think I've always been most fascinated with the atom, which is the smallest piece of human life, the smallest unit of ordinary matter that forms a chemical element. The atom is evidently made up of two or three parts, a nucleus, which has a proton and a neutron, cells to join in the nucleus, and electrons that fly around in orbit around this nucleus. And I've often wondered how fast they move, these electrons, just continually in every direction, going round and round the nucleus. Well, it turns out that using certain dielectric constanting space and size and blah, 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 an estimate of the speed of the electron in the circular orbit of the hydrogen atom, this is an hydrogen atom, is about 2,188 kilometers per second. It's a faster going. And that's quite fast, because if you think of 2,200 kilometers, that's about from here to Brandon, Manitoba. Now, we went through there a while back in my pickup truck. It took us 2.5 days. But the electron takes 1 second to go 22,000 kilometers. I have to ask the question again, because I'm simple. I look at these things simple. Did that evolve? I don't think so. But here's what I believe. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our own image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Going back for just a second to the atom, what is it in fact? It's a nucleus with electrons rotating around it. As a small universe, actually, a space between, lots of space between the electron and the nucleus. So what we can say, God created us in his own image. But the sad fact for us to realize is that we're just space. We're just made up of electromagnetic force spinning around trillions of smaller universes all inside us, all held together by the Creator's glue. No, the living God created this. And so we'll spend a few moments. I don't like to beg for your indulgence, but we have a few more slides I'd like to go through here in relation to archaeology. Archaeology supports the Bible narrative in places, and of course, this is the Word of God, the Bible, and it is being supported now by archaeological discovery. And one of the problems that they had for many, many years is that they didn't think Sodom and Gomorrah existed. They had no idea where that was. They thought it was just a fairy story. Well, now there's been extensive research done in the area of the southern Jordan Valley, just north of the Dead Sea. And in a highly technical report published in Scientific Reports, an online peer-reviewed journal, and always already assessed by more 100,000 times, noted in conclusion the similarity of the findings of the biblical account of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Conclusion, there are no known ancient writings or books of the Bible other than Genesis that describe what would be construed as the destruction of a city by an airburst impact event. So they have concluded, those who are digging around through the ruins, that this in fact is Sodom, a place they call Tel Hamon, that this is the ruins of Sodom. They found it. And the evidence on the ground is that there was an airburst, like a meteor bursting above the city and turning it into salt, a fireball, essentially, that hit this area about 1800 BC. There's a group of cities just north of the Dead Sea in the southern Jordan Valley that Abraham was familiar with, and Sodom and Gomorrah were over on your right, Numbers 8 and 9, and there has been lots of excavation done around there in the last 20 years. Go back to Genesis chapter 13, and Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the garden in the land of Egypt, in the direction of Zoar. So Lot is standing down about midway to the left, below Jericho, on the hills, looking across this valley that was the end waters of the Jordan River going into the Dead Sea. And it was a beautiful green lush valley. And there was this discussion about where their flocks and herds were going to go in the family of Abraham. And so Lot saw that and said, let's go down there. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. Now after this airburst had happened, Genesis 19:23, the sun had risen on the earth. When Lot came to Zoar, he fled to Zoar, escaped. The Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. This sounds like an airburst. He overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. He turned the whole place into salt, basically, including Lot's wife. She hung around too long. There was some urgency, of course, because of the meteor coming down that's going to burst. They're timed very specifically. And Abraham went out early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord, and he looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah, to all the land in the valley, and he looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So they've been digging around there, and amazingly, they've found some very interesting things. During the excavations of Tel el-Hamon in 2013, a large gatehouse with pillars was found behind the main entrance of the Middle Bronze Age city. This reconstruction drawing shows that the main gate of Tel el-Hamon would have looked like, as the excavator of this archaeological site has identified this spot with Sodom. It appears that this was the gate mentioned in Genesis 19:1, where we read that Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. The drawing shows a right angled pathway through the gatehouse with a space at the side where the elders and judges of the city congregated. And this particular diagram happens to be one that was drawn by a member of our community whose name is Lean Whitmire, who worked on this site. So move on from there, because again, we don't have a lot of time. So one other thought and thing that always fascinated me about the scriptures and about archaeology was the existence of the Hittites. Now, the existence of the Hittites was argued. People going back centuries, said that that was just a, again, a fairy story, and just part of the biblical narrative was, doesn't make any sense. But it turns out that Abraham, when he left Ur of the Chaldees, which is right down on your right, he went right up into Syria, modern Syria today, close to Turkey, to a town called Haran. Subsequently, he went down through Sidon, Tyre, Jerusalem, Gaza, and through to Egypt, and then back up and lived around Hebron. And it turns out that as he was moving, that the Hittite Empire that was up to the north was receding at that particular time in history, as was the Egyptian Empire. And these two empires had been intersecting with each other for a number of years, hundreds of years. But when Abraham moved down into the land of Israel, as we know it today, these two nations had receded. And so what Abraham found was remnants of the Hittite people who were living there. And I'll just make this point, that for many years, biblical skeptics kept bringing up the fact that the Hittites were a myth and that these people only existed in the Bible. And that is until archaeologists uncovered evidence of such a nation. The Hittites had apparently been around for many centuries and stayed in power up until the 15th, 16th centuries. B.C., excuse me. We read of Hittites in the Bible. Uriah the Hittite was one of the most powerful warriors in David, King David's army, 2 Samuel 11. And even long after the nation of Israel returned from captivity, hundreds of years later, the Hittites were still a formidable nation to be dealt with in the book of Ezra, which was 400 some odd years before the birth of Christ. King David's army was, of course, about 1,000. So they're out there. In classical times, Hittite dynasties survived in small kingdoms scattered around the areas of present-day Syria, Lebanon, and the Levant. So the Bible is true. The Bible record is correct and puts Abraham and many of the Jewish nation correctly in place in time and history with the Hittites. And here we have Abraham buying a piece of property from a Hittite to bury his family. We have David's mighty man, Uriah the Hittite. We have a nation, an army, a Hittite army that was threatening the Jewish people about 800 BC, 2 Kings chapter 7 and 6. We have, again, the mention of the Hittites in Ezra chapter 9, verse 1. Apart from that, during the 19th century, many academics claimed Jesus never existed. This only goes back a couple of hundred years. And that most of the people, places, and events of the New Testament were invented. But with the tremendous evidence that we have today, such dismissiveness, says Metaxas, is inconceivable. And of course, there has been a massive amount of exploration in the Holy Land, as we call it, around Jerusalem especially. Steps where Pilate walked, steps where Jesus sat and talked to his disciples. Ruins that seem to indicate that the house of Mary and Joseph, maybe Peter, was clearly there in the place where they lived. A synagogue in Capernaum, which is still there. The Dead Sea Scrolls. Connections between the Pool of Siloam, which was a place that Jesus knew well, and Hezekiah's tunnel. The Jerusalem temple itself, exact references to Pilate, and so on. There is plenty of evidence in New Testament archaeology to back up the New Testament account. So what's the takeaway? If we believe in the God of the Bible, we have the high ground. Let's think about this in relation to people telling us we're stupid because we believe in God. No, if we believe in the God of the Bible, we have the high ground. If we believe in the God of the Bible and the God of Israel, we have the high ground. If we believe in the God of the Bible and the God of Israel, we believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. If we believe in Jesus, the Son of God, we believe in the miracle of resurrection. If we believe in the miracle of resurrection, we believe in the miracle of creation. If we believe in creation, We don't have to be intimidated by the atheists. Because now there is overwhelming evidence that they are wrong and that there is a God. Overwhelming proof. This God has fine-tuned our universe and everything in it, our solar system and the universe and so on. Do not let them say you are stupid or uneducated because you believe in God. Don't let them get away with that. Do not let them bully or intimidate you or gaslight you into their thinking. Because that's actually their only way out. It's not you who's the fool. It's them. And the evidential tide has now clearly turned. Do not shy away anymore from intelligent, logical discussions about the one true God of the Bible, a creator God who has fine-tuned the universe. King David said, Psalm 41, verse 14, verse 1, it's the fool that says in his heart, there is no God. It's the atheist that says there is no God that is the fool. And I find this verse useful. By Solomon, David's son, maybe 50 years later, Proverbs 29 and 9. Think about it. The wise man has an argument with a fool. The fool only rages and laughs. That's their way out. They don't have a solid argument. They don't have truth. So what they do is they take the ad hominem approach, attack you personally. They gaslight you and they rage and they make fun of you and laugh at you. Have no fear of them. I have some words from Jesus. So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered that will not be revealed or hidden that will not be made known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light, and what you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. Do not, in closing, I must say, do not let them bully you into their thinking that you're stupid or uneducated because you believe in the God of creation. There is no rational basis for the argument for atheism. And having said that, you do not need to fear what they say. Their argument is no longer supported by any facts. And as you clearly present them your truth, they will quickly resort to the personal ad hominem response of attacking your intelligence, gaslighting you, laughing at you. It's all predictable, the way they respond. To close with another few words of Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me." And Elisha the prophet, who was supporting one of his people afraid of an invasion, said, "Do not be afraid, for there those who are with us, those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And finally, John, 1 John 4, verse 4, he said, "Little children, you are from God and have overcome them. For he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world." Yes, let not your hearts be troubled. Amen.